Welcome to St. Anne's on Tap, the podcast of St. Anne's Public House. St. Anne's Public House is a Christian audio journal of theology and culture.
Welcome to episode 29 of St. Anne's on Tap. I'm Michael Collender. Our most downloaded issue has been our two-part issue titled An Evangelical Tribute to Whiskey. In this podcast episode, we give you the sober side of that issue, which features a whiskey tasting as well as some fantastic music and movie reviews. The next podcast episode will feature the intoxicated side, which shares some pretty strange stuff. When you get to the credits, keep in mind that we have changed offices several times since we began pouring content back in 2002, and that the address in the credits is now no longer our digs. The best way to reach us is through our website at stannespub.com. And thanks for listening to St. Anne's Public House.
Welcome to the winter 2007 edition of St. Anne's Public House. My name is Yost Nixon, and I am your host. Fuller Warren, Florida's governor in the 1950s, was running for office in a year that counties were voting their local option on permitting the sale of liquor. Asked for his position on wet versus dry, he would say, "If by whiskey you mean the water of life that cheers men's souls, that smooths out the tensions of the day, that gives gentle perspective to one's view of life, then put my name on the list of the fervent wets. But if by whiskey you mean the devil's brew that rends families, destroys careers, and ruins one's ability to work, then count me in the ranks of the dries." In this little tribute to whiskey, the staff at St. Anne's Pub is referring to the cheery, perspective-giving stuff rather than the devil's brew. After all, the Bible gives us both perspectives. In Deuteronomy 14, God is pouring the strong drink. But then, in Proverbs 20, he's bouncing the babbling brawlers out. 86, no more for you. But then, 11 chapters later, he is there at the sickbed spooning strong drink into a dying man's mouth. The lesson seems to be that we should beware simplistic generalization and stick closer to our Bibles. So to help this all along, we raise our evangelical, gospel-loving snifters in tribute to whiskey, saying, "Thank you, Lord, for the process of fermentation." But this winter issue of St. Anne's Pub is coming out in an election year. And having already survived a 20-year Clinton-Bush internment, with the prospect of another 8 years hard time, we decided that we'd better make it a double. Select your CD according to your mood. Our sober CD you've already found. It is our sober celebration of what is perhaps the most calumniated of beverages. Milk turns up her prissy nose whenever whiskey comes around, as if it were somehow beneath her. Coke just assumes that whiskey is desperate for company, any company, and so it hangs about, trying out annoying pickup lines. It's time whiskey got some respect from evangelicals. So our first CD in this issue is dedicated to rehabilitating a tarnished image. In the last century, whiskey has been typecast as a thug, when it really belongs in the role of the aristocrat. To help us along, Chris True speaks with whiskey expert Bruce Ridley, who tells us why John Barleycorn must die. But then, there are those droller moods. And for those, we recommend CD number 2. For instance, have you ever thought of moonlighting as a tabloid journalist? We certainly have, and so we rung up former tabloid writer Tom D'Antoni, who is author of the book Rabid Nun Infects Entire Convent. We spoke to him about how to break into the business. Or, though tabloids may not be for you, you have wondered what that piece of metal is floating around in your arm. You don't remember taking any shrapnel in Vietnam. In fact, you've never been within 1,000 miles of a combat zone. Or there's that worrisome feeling that something otherworldly happened to you during that 90-minute stretch you can't account for last March. To help us explore such anomalies, we invite alien abductee Timothy Cullen to St. Anne's Pub, along with surgeon Dr. Lear, who removed the implant that the aliens placed within Mr. Cullen's body. Dr. Lear specializes in removing and analyzing alien implants and has been featured on the Discovery Channel. Of course, along with our interviews, you'll find the usually slightly fermented content. We trust you'll enjoy your visit to St. Anne's Pub, find yourself a corner, pour yourself a dram, and join the conversation.
In March 1999, famed male supermodel Fabio was among the first to ride the new Apollo's Chariot roller coaster at Busch Gardens in Williamsburg, Virginia. While Fabio enjoyed the ride, he did have one minor complaint. He was hit in the face by a 20-pound flying goose.
I'm not a real movie star. I've still got the same wife I started out with 28 years ago. Will Rogers.
Thank you.
That was Stress Being Reels in A by Shira Kamen.
Ratatouille. The first thing that God tells man about the world is that it is edible. See this world around you? You can eat it. When God makes Adam and Eve in his image, we learn four things about God's image right off the bat. God's image is male and female. God's image was created to be fruitful and multiply. God's image is to have dominion. And God's image is created hungry. Adam and Eve were created to make love, start a career, and eat the whole world. And God said, "See, I have given you every herb that yields seed, which is on the face of all the earth, and every tree whose fruit yields seeds. To you it shall be for food." Food is one of the great mysteries of creation. When we are happy, we use food to celebrate. When we are sad, we use food to commiserate. When someone we love is struck, we use food to console. When we are in love, we send food to demonstrate. And in every case, food works. There's nothing like 2 pounds of chocolates to say I love you. And there's nothing like sherry poppy seed pound cake to say congratulations, or a plate of brownies to say we are thinking of you in this difficult time. Food has powers that almost nothing else has. You can keep any manner of people peacefully enjoying one another's company, provided that the barbecue sauce is good enough. On a recent jaunt to perhaps the only must-visit restaurant in Spokane, Chicken Mo, I realized that it was perhaps the oddest conglomeration of people I have ever been a part of. There were 2 men in pinstriped suits, several black youths that looked to be in high school, 3 20-something punk rockers, a young father who looked as if he drove a sensible Japanese car, treating his 4-year-old, a pastor who also happens to be the executive producer of a successful Christian audio cultural journal, and myself. Huh, I thought to myself. The only other time I've experienced this kind of diversity was under government coercion. Brad Bird's newest movie, Ratatouille, captures the mystery and power of food. Food is at the center of the life of any family, central to the life of any culture, and central to the health of our soul. If you haven't seen Ratatouille, then let me warn you that I am about to give away the ending, as well as the ending of The Incredibles and The Iron Giant in my later reviews. So if you don't want to have the ending spoiled, then quick, skip to the next track. I will give you a moment to find the button on that old car stereo. Ratatouille is about a rat named Remy, who wants to be a chef, who comes from a family of rats who are part of a colony of rats that are interested in being rats. Remy is separated from his family and given the opportunity to become a chef in Paris, wherein hilarity ensues. He teams up with Linguini the Plongeur, a.k.a. Garbage Boy, who, unbeknownst to the world, is the child of the perhaps illicit affair of the dead chef who made the restaurant famous in the first place. The ex-sous-chef, now head chef Skinner, who is a money-grubbing, microwavable, fast-food-pushing mini-man with a big hat, a small soul, and a tongue of sawdust, is running the restaurant and the name of Gusteau into the ground, until the rumor of the talent of Remy and Linguini begins to spread through town. Well, thankfully, it turns out that Linguini is the long-lost heir of Gusteau, and Linguini ends up with the restaurant and begins to restore the name of Gusteau, and then the famed and feared food critic Anton Ego, whose bad review of Gusteau is subtly blamed for Gusteau's untimely death, shows up at the announcement of Linguini's new ownership of the restaurant and extends a challenge to Linguini. Linguini's response is, "You're thin for a guy who likes food," but Ego insists that he doesn't like food, he loves it, and if he puts something in his mouth that he doesn't love, he spits it out. It is immediately apparent that Ego loves food but hates people, but food doesn't work that way. Later that day, Linguini begins to act like Anton Ego and is decidedly mean to Remy, so Remy goes and gets the colony of rats to come and take all the food, but then Linguini shows up and apologizes. Remy feels bad for acting out of bitterness, but then Linguini sees that Remy is raiding the kitchen and throws him out, and then Remy is captured, but then Remy's family helps him escape, and Remy goes back to help Linguini, and Linguini quits acting like Ego and humbles himself and tells the whole kitchen staff that it's really a rat behind Linguini's success, and the kitchen staff walks out on him, so Remy gets the rat colony and helps him cook for the evening, but then the health inspector shows up, and they have to tie up the health inspector and throw him in the walk-in refrigerator, and then Anton Ego arrives in order to review the restaurant. Whew. And Remy decides to serve Anton Ego ratatouille, a peasant dish. It is now time for a confession. Don't tell anyone, but I saw this movie twice, and when Anton Ego took a bite of ratatouille and remembered his mother comforting him as a child with ratatouille, I cried. Both times. Now, I'm not exactly known for fits of emotion. In fact, I generally have the emotional depth of a mud puddle. But to see a man broken by the memory of his mother comforting him when he was a boy with a scraped knee was almost more than I could handle. It was moving and beautiful and not at all preachy. There is nothing like our mother's cookie to keep us humble or to remind us that we should eat food and not our neighbor. There are so many similarities to the church and the Lord's Supper that it pains me not to make it preachy with the sermon, but that would invade the simplicity of Brad Bird's artistry. Needless to say, the food changes everything for Ego. He is humbled and repents publicly in his column. He loses his job, his respect, and his credibility. But what we learn is that in losing everything, he gains everything. At the end, we see an Ego with friends for the first time, enjoying himself as part of a restaurant family. And that same meal of ratatouille that brought freedom to Ego landed Skinner tied up in the walk-in. A king's son was getting married, and the king sent out the palace servants to announce that he was throwing a party and that there would be a great feast. He wasn't giving a lecture series or a political rally in honor of the wedding. He was preparing a feast, and when no one came, he went out to the highways and the byways and gathered the poor and wretched, and he fed them. Just like God in the garden, the king laid a feast before his people.
Philip Doddridge, Epigram on His Family Arms. Live while you live, the epicure would say, and seize the pleasure of each passing day. Live while you live, the sacred preacher cries, and give to God each moment as it flies. Lord, in my view, let both united be. I live in pleasure when I live to thee.
There is more refreshment and stimulation in a nap, even of the briefest, than in all the alcohol ever distilled. Ovid.
Anyway, no drug, not even alcohol, causes the fundamental ills of society. If we're looking for the source of our troubles, we shouldn't test people for drugs. We should test them for stupidity, ignorance, greed, and love of power. P.J. O'Rourke.
Busy, curious, thirsty fly, drink with me and drink as I. Freely welcome to my cup, course the sip and sip it up. Make the most of life you may. Life is short and wears away. Life is short and wears away. Both alike are mine and thine. Hasten quick to their decline. Thine's a summer, mine no more. Though augmented to threescore. Threescore summers when they're gone will appear as short as one. Will appear as short as one.
That was The Fly by Emma Curtis in The Frolic.
The year is 701 BC. Sennacherib, the king of Assyria, has surrounded the city of Jerusalem. His messenger stands before the walls of the city and announces her doom. No one in the city had any illusions as to the nature of their doom. Death and exile awaited them. They would be torn from their homes, sent into a foreign land, likely seeing Jerusalem never again. But this view of their destiny is quite pessimistic. And so Sennacherib, like all good tyrants, endeavors to paint the future that awaited the citizens of Jerusalem in glowing terms. It's really not exile, hunger, forced marches, and shame that you will endure, he claims. No, the future is much more bright. I am Stuart Bryan, and this is Ancient Biography. In 1 Kings chapter 18, verses 31 and 32, Sennacherib's messenger tries to get the citizens of Jerusalem to open the gates of the city by making grandiose promises to the people. Quote, "Do not listen to Hezekiah, for thus says the king of Assyria, make peace with me by a present and come out to me, and every one of you eat from his own vine, and every one from his own fig tree, and every one of you drink the waters of his own cistern, until I come and take you away to a land like your own land, a land of grain and new wine, a land of bread and vineyards, a land of olive groves and honey, that you may live and not die. But do not trust Hezekiah, lest he persuade you, saying, the Lord will deliver us. End quote. You've got my intentions all mixed up, Sennacherib declares. I'm really bringing joy and harmony your way. The future under my rule is bright. To us, the offer of the king of Assyria seems patently absurd, for we know all about the Assyrians. Their brutality was and is legendary. Masters of the most current military technology and ignorant of all ethical restraint, they not infrequently slaughtered entire cities and repopulated them with inhabitants from other lands. Listen as one of their kings boasts of his exploits. Quote, many of the defeated I took as living captives. From some I cut off their hands and their fingers. From others I cut off their noses, their ears, and their fingers. Of many I put out the eyes. I made one pile of the living and another of heads, and I bound their heads to stakes round about the city. Their young men and maidens I burned in the fire. The city I destroyed, I devastated, I burned it with fire and consumed it. End quote. This is what the inhabitants of Jerusalem could in reality anticipate. But this blunt description is what you provide after the victory is won. In the meantime, Sennacherib knew, promise them the world. The offer which Sennacherib makes contrasts vividly with the reality which was lying in wait and teaches us valuable lessons about the nature of temptation. All temptation gets its force from twisting the facts and making it appear that satisfaction and joy lie where they, in fact, do not. Satan is no fool. And like Sennacherib, he knows that no one will submit ahead of time to one who promises them feces for supper and urine for dessert. And so he couches his temptations in the most plausible of disguises. Whether it's Eve beholding the fruit which is good to make one wise, or the children of Israel longing for the leeks and onions they enjoyed in Egypt, the nature of temptation is always the same. Satan endeavors to make it look attractive. He wants to be the one who defines the good life, the life that makes one truly happy. But note that he has no interest in our happiness. Just like Sennacherib had no intention of making the life of the Judahites as pleasant as he promised. Like the pagan gods of antiquity, the demons who owed their origin to his machinations, Satan is selfish and consuming, promising the good life, but bringing destruction to all those who succumb to his wiles. And so the lesson of Sennacherib is the lesson of James. Submit to God, resist the devil, and he will flee from you. And Sennacherib's destruction reminds us that the final defeat of the devil is equally as certain.
Carolyn's Concerto, Decamera. Bruce Ridley tasted his first whiskey, a Glenfiddich 12-year bottling, in college 37 years ago. Since then, he has amassed a collection of over 160 single malt whiskeys and tasted thousands of different bottlings. Bruce has led whiskey tastings of up to 120 persons in Washington, Oregon, Montana, California, New Mexico, Arizona, Illinois, and Florida. He has been asked to analyze single casks of certain bottlings stores are considering purchasing and having bottled. Bruce is a member of Clan Buchanan and wears his clan's kilt to whiskey tastings. 15 years ago, Bowmore Distillery conferred upon him the honorary title of Master of Malt. At that point, Bruce could identify each single malt whiskey by nose and taste.
Bruce, welcome to St. Anne's Pub.
Thank you.
Bruce, what is whiskey and why should I care?
Well, whiskey is basically distilled beer. If you take beer and you run it through a couple of old-type stills, you get a very full-flavored whiskey. In the U.S., whenever it's spelled W-H-I-S-K-E-Y, it's spirits made from corn mostly, and it's run through a couple of old pot stills. You've probably seen the pictures of them in revenue or stories and people chasing illegal distillers around Kentucky. Well, the same thing happened in Scotland and in Ireland for a while until things got legalized. The reason we should drink it is that it has wonderful flavors. And the idea is not to get drunk with it, but to enjoy all the flavors and to think about it. With a good single malt Scotch whiskey, I'll sometimes spend 20 to 30 minutes just nosing it, trying to get all the flavors out of the nose. For instance, in a Glenmorangie 10, the standard bottling, there are 28 different floral essences on the nose. And I know a French perfumer who can name them all. And he'll literally just smell the top of the rim of the glass for 20 minutes before he gets down to the rest of the whiskey. So it's for enjoyment, but it's for a cerebral enjoyment generally.
So what is a proper glass with which to drink whiskey?
Well, that becomes an argument. I've written articles on the subject and letters on the subject, and I've discussed it with various friends in various continents. Basically, you should try some sort of glass that has a shape which is wider at the bottom and narrower at the top, so that it makes all the alcohol which is in the bottom push forward all the flavors upwards and then captures them in a very narrow place. Now, that can depend a lot. I favor enormous snifters from 70 to 80 ounces that are basically bell-shaped. And they have two functions. With them, I can tip a glass to the side so that the face of the glass, the open part, is vertical, and no whiskey pours out because I've only put something like a quarter of a shot in there. And then all the alcohol pushes the whiskey the alcohol pushes all the esters up the back of the glass, and then the alcohol stays at the top of that bell, which is now tipped sideways, and the esters get pushed out and rise up by their and come out of the mouth by their atomic layers, so that the lightest are on the top, say floral essences, and then right underneath them, if you think of the glass as a clock face, at 12 o'clock you'll get spices, and from the 10 to 2 line you'll probably get all the herbs. And then right in the middle, you'll get wood and flavors that come from the whiskey being in a cask. Oak generally will produce vanilla, and a sherry cask will produce a sort of rich macadamia nut. While the center of an oak cask that's been used for bourbon generally produces vanilla and a dry nut like a walnut, and then down about from the 4 to 8 part of the glass, you won't get much in bourbons, but in a single malt Scotch whiskey, you'll get a flavors of earth and sometimes seaweed, depending on the peat bogs, which were used to dry the barley. So now, and then there's the other type of glass, which is very small and narrow. It looks sort of like a miniature champagne flute. And it does just the opposite, whereas the large glass spreads everything out. The small glass focuses all those flavors into one total nose. And that's sometimes harder for a new person to use because they can't distinguish what's in the glass and from their nose, but the big one will separate it all out for them and show the intricacies.
Let's talk a minute about the various kinds of whiskey.
As to whiskeys, they're all distilled spirits, but the original was Irish whiskey. Somewhere between 900 and 1100 A.D., the Christians drove the Moors out of Spain, and the Spanish libraries, which they seized, well, the Moorish libraries, which they seized, had the greatest collection of literature in the world at that time. Problem was that most of the people around that time were illiterate, and they couldn't read them. The only people who could read effectively were the monks in the various countries. Well, Ireland had the largest percentage of religious sanctuaries of various types, and they actually had the most literate society in Europe as a result in the Middle Ages. And then this created this odd happenstance where all of these books were then shipped up to Ireland so that the monks could translate them from Arabic into originally not English but into Latin. And amongst those were records on how to distill beer. Now, some people say that was originally done by the Celts, but there's really no record of it. What there is a record that from China, probably somewhere around 500 AD in the Middle East, that spirits were being distilled in much the same way that they are today. Not as in the biggest scale, but you'd get a copper still, and you'd run what they call a worm over the top. It's a condenser. You heat the bottom of the still. Pressure forces the alcohol up through, and it condenses the alcohol out of the steam, and then at the end of the condenser is a pot where you collect it. Well, it originally started as Irish whiskey, and within, let's see, it was 1491, there's a record of a friar in Scotland buying 20 bowls, which is a unit of measurement, of barley for making aqua vitae, which is the water, means the water of life. That became Scotch whiskey. During something called the Clearances, where a lot of the Scots were chased out of Scotland because the lords found that they could make a lot more money running sheep on these marginal areas than having people try and give them a tenth of something they couldn't earn. And then in Ireland, the potato famine did much the same thing. So you had all these Irishmen and Scots-Irishmen from the Northern Ireland area and Scotsmen all going over, and most of them settled in the Kentucky-Tennessee area. And they didn't have any barley, but they said, wow, look at all this corn. And it had lots more sugar than barley did, and it was a lot easier, so all of a sudden stills were popping up everywhere. It was also a good way for people to make money when they didn't have much at the time. And then the other spirits that you find, the gin and the vodka, well, it's really sort of interesting because Stolichnicha vodka in Russian basically means water of life. And akavit in Sweden and Denmark means water of life. So wherever you have a northern clime and things got really dark and dreary in the winter and you had 5 hours of daylight and it was mostly either full of snow or full of blizzards, you had the water of life, which is interesting because it was first named aqua vitae by the church, by the Catholic Church. So that's how many types there are, and they vary in how they're made. So that's sort of the next step, if you'd like me to go there.
Yeah. So how do we make whiskey?
How do we make whiskey? Okay.
In the most basic way.
In the most basic way, the first thing you have to do is make a beer. And then for Scotch and Irish whiskey, you take barley, which is what grows there. The climate's not warm enough for corn and it's too wet for corn in the right or wrong seasons. With barley, the problem is each kernel only has starch in it. It doesn't have any sugar yet. What you have to do is you have to dry the kernel of barley, then you wet it, and the sprout starts sprouting. When the sprout starts sprouting, it creates two enzymes which convert all of the starch into sugars. Then you have to stop the sprout from eating the barley, so you heat it. There's a song called John Barleycorn, which you might have heard, John Barleycorn Must Die. It's basically a song about how you go from this step all the way into making whiskey. Once you have the sprout happily converting all the starch to sugar, you add heat and you kill the sprout, leaving the sugar. Well, in Ireland, they used peat, but they vented the smoke so that it didn't come into the barley. In Scotland, instead, they let the smoke go right up through the barley, and that's a process called malting it.
And that peat being?
Peat comes from bogs. If you've ever seen peat moss, that's basically peat that's been in a bog somewhere. The bogs have different types of stuff falling into them, and then they sit and they sort of get compressed, so they're sort of like pre-coal, and you can use them for a heat source. Well, in Ireland and in Scotland, there just weren't any trees, and there was not much coal. The trees were all on the Lord's estates, and everything else had been cut down, but there were lots of peat bogs, and most of the Irish and the Scots would have what they called black houses, and literally they would have a house with a hole in the top of the roof in the center and a hearth down in the middle, and they would burn this peat, which was really smoky. So everything in the house got blackened. It's also a reason why their life expectancy was under 40 years, I think. Everybody probably died of cancer. Any rate, so if you've ever barbecued with different types of wood, you know that if you barbecue with mesquite, you get a totally different flavor than if you barbecue with cherry or oak or something. Well, if you have a peat bog that's in an area where ages ago it was full of huge trees, then you're going to have lots of leaves fall in and trees fall in, and as they slowly broken down, all those flavors of the trees come in there. And for instance, a tree, you get bark, and what's cinnamon? It's a bark. You get all the leaves. What are leaves? Are herbs. Then you go north of that area a little bit, and maybe you come to a place where there never really were too many trees because of the high winds, and so there you'll have a lot of wild grasses and wildflowers. And then there's a place, a couple of places on the west coast and on islands on the west coast of Scotland where the peat bogs at various times were under the sea. And so they have layers of seaweed and little animals in them. And when you burn that peat, you get a very iodinic nose from those flavors. So once you've done this in either fashion, you now have a dried sugarful kernel, and you crush it. Then you put it into a big tub. This is pretty much the same thing that's done with corn too. Either way, you put the kernels, you crush the kernels, you put them in big tubs, and you run hot water through them, and the hot water picks up all the sugar. Usually, you do that two or three times because each wash with succeeding heat takes a little more sugar. And you've finally gotten all the sugar out, and you save, being very thrifty, since you're of Scots or Irish heritage, you save the rest of what's left, and you feed that to your cattle. Then you take your sugar water, and you add yeast, and you put it into a big tank called a steep, and you just let it bubble. And as the yeast eats the sugar, it creates alcohol. And that's how you make beer. And that's exactly what happens if you go to a brewery today. You'll see that happening. Well, then the next step is you take this beer, although it's usually allowed to get as high an alcohol percentage as it can get beforehand, and then you run it through a series of two or three smaller stills if you want to get a whiskey with flavor. If you want to get a whiskey without flavor, that's totally clear, then you use what's called a continuous process still, and that makes gin or vodka, which come from different sources. Vodka can be potatoes or most anything. And the only real difference between gin and vodka is that someone puts juniper berries into the gin, and that's what the gin flavor is. Otherwise, it would be totally tasteless like vodka. Mm-hmm. And that's how one makes whiskey.
The other day, I sat in with you and maybe a dozen other people, as you tasted several Scotch whiskies. The process that you used was very much different from a group of people sitting around drinking. In fact, it seemed to me that very little whiskey was actually consumed. I wonder if you would describe that process and what you were doing,
well,
both individually and kind of as a group. What was going on there?
Well, basically, we're all trying to find out what those flavors are that are in the whiskey. And there are three parts to it. There's the nose, where you sit around and you discuss what you smell on the nose. And then as you pour the whiskey into your mouth and it flows through your mouth, you'll find that there are different flavors that come out all the way across from the tip of your tongue all the way toward the back. For instance, there's one whiskey, a couple of whiskeys actually, Lafroig being the most noteworthy one, where the first taste you taste on the tip of your tongue is seaweed. And that's one from those Islay whiskeys from the island peat bogs where they've been under the water. So the taste will actually flow all the way across the tongue. Now, at one point, one of the most consistent whiskeys was called the Macallan, and it had 14 flavors that ran across the tongue one after the other in their 18-year-old, and it immediately, by rolling it across the tongue, you could identify those flavors. Then when you swallow the whiskey, you will get more flavors coming up in what they call the finish. And that can be anywhere from no finish, if the whiskey was made with not too much attention to getting the best part of the distillation out. In that case, there's big metal molecules that collect all the flavors and you never get to taste them because the metal molecules don't break up when they go down on your throat. But usually most of the molecules that are still collected together are relatively simple and small. So when they hit your throat, which is much denser, they start breaking up. And as they break up, all the flavors come right up. And then, and if you inhale, you actually, and then exhale, you'll get all those flavors coming up. The best finishes are 4.5 minutes long. If you can figure, if I spend 15 minutes tasting a nose and 4 or 5 minutes after I swallowed a little bit, you can see that I'm not, I don't think there's a way to get drunk doing it. And I only take about a quarter of a shot each time. So I think that night we went for about 2.5 to 3 hours, and I think I had basically one shot of whiskey in that entire night. So,
well, now, wouldn't it take a great deal of practice, time to get to the point where that would even be enjoyable?
Not really. You'll first be able to identify some basic things. And when I started doing it, I had a real hard time trying to discern flavors because you can smell something, but you don't know what it is. And then I had an epiphany, and I realized that if I tied flavors to things that I had cooked or I had eaten, then I could identify them. Here's a great example. There's a wonderful whiskey called Glen Grant. And it changes as it ages in the barrel. So that at 10 years old or 12 years old, it has a flavor of sort of very sweet lemon peel on the nose. But at 25 years old, the first time I smelled it, I was sort of expecting this lemon peel, and I didn't get anything like it. It was just sort of off-putting in the way that I didn't know what it was because I wasn't expecting it. And I was actually drinking the whiskey with one of our winemakers in town, Mike Scott of Lone Canary. And Mike said, "Smells like my mom's apple pie." And I thought, that's it, green apples and cinnamon. And it was. That was what it was. No. So ever since then, whenever I try and think about a whiskey, I try and think of the flavors I use or that I smell in cooking. For instance, a lot of times if you smell Italian, a sort of an Italian nose off of something, it's probably things like basil and oregano. And those are herbs. And the Scots have lots of herbs. Herbs are basically weeds that people cultivated. One of theirs is called chervil. And chervil is a cross sort of between mint and basil. You can actually buy chervil in the stores these days. So once you get to do that, you can say, okay, these are those, I remember those. And then spices, you just think of baking. Cinnamon, nutmeg, all sorts of pepper, all sorts of spices are in these too. And it's not that they have that exact spice in them. It's that when whatever herbs or whatever elements were in there in the peat bog, when they're burned, bring those aromas up. And so what you're doing is just saying this aroma is close enough. The meetings then do serve three purposes. We get together and enjoy each other's company. We each get to hone our flavors, our analytical skills, so that we can get our flavors described. And we learn from each other. Most people have a better sense of some part of the aroma spectrum than they do others. It's a very rare person who can go from the light floral to the heaviest earthy flavors and have the exact same great spectrum. A lot of people, I think it's just they aren't used to using it. So this, as we go along, we get a lot better.
Well, Bruce, thank you for joining us today at St. Anne's Pub.
You're welcome. Thank you very much.
There were three men came out of the west, their fortunes for to try. And these three men made a solemn vow, John Barleycorn should die. They ploughed, they sowed, they harrowed him in, threw clods upon his head. And these three men made a solemn vow, John Barleycorn was dead. They let him die for a very long time, till the rains from heaven did fall. And little Sir John sprung up his head, and so amazed them all. There he let him stand till Midsummer's Day, till he looked both pale and worn. And little Sir John, he's grown a long beard, and so became a man. So sharp to cut him off down by the knee. They've rolled and they've tied him by the waist, served him most barbarously. They hired men with the sharp pitchforks who pricked him through the heart. And the loader, he served him worse than that, for he bound him to the cart. Wheeled him around and around the field, till they came unto a barn. And there they made a solemn oath, a poor old Barleycorn. They hired men with the crabtree sticks to cut him skin from bone. And the miller, he served him worse than that, for he's ground in between two stones. Little Sir John and the nut brown bowl and his brandy in the glass. And little Sir John and the nut brown bowl proved a stronger man at last. For the huntsman, he can't hunt the fox nor so proudly blow his horn. And the tinker, he can't mend kettles nor pots without a little of barley corn.
That was John Barleycorn by Shira Kamen.
The Incredibles. Brad Bird's breakout movie was The Incredibles. It was about a family of superheroes trying to hide the fact that they are super so that they won't get sued. Again. The Incredibles, like Ratatouille, is a complex plot that is unapologetic with its complexity and subtlety. The main character, Bob Parr, aka Mr. Incredible, is struggling with settling down and no longer being super, even though the first line that he has in the movie is that he would like to settle down. He is so wrapped up in himself that he is not living for his family. He is selfishly distracted by his desires to be important to the world, and so he is dropping the ball where he is already important to his family. That is when an opportunity to work as a superhero comes up again. He takes the opportunity, though he doesn't tell his family, but it turns out to be a trap. There are three important turning points in the story, all of which take Bob through death experiences that kill his selfishness. First, when he realizes that he has been trapped, he escapes by diving off a cliff. He falls down to the water, down under the water, swims down into an underground cave that turns out to be a tomb, and he hides underneath the dead body of an old friend and is declared lifeless by Syndrome's computer. If that is not a symbolic death, then I don't know what is. When he escapes, he sneaks back into Syndrome's lair and opens his computer to find that most of his old friends are dead. But he is captured because he hid his plans from his wife. When he is captured, he is taken into an underground dungeon and hung cruciform and powerless. He has gone from great power to utter weakness, and then, while he is hanging in complete vulnerability, Syndrome kills his family right in front of him. Everything has been taken away from him, and it is at this point that he is tempted by a way of escape that involves cruelty and destruction, but instead, he shows mercy. Because he shows mercy, he gets everything back, and he even gets to save the world again, just like he always wanted. But this time, he saves the world by leading his family, rather than instead of leading his family. It would perhaps be a bit of an understatement to say that Hollywood in general, and Disney in particular, have lost their family-friendly touch. But Brad Bird seems to be bringing it back. Mr. Incredible is manly, but unsuccessfully manly, because he is not manly for or with his family. But when he dies to himself, he does not lose his manliness, but becomes even stronger, and his wife, his kids, and even the city that he longed to protect respect him all the more. There is also more than one shot taken at the silliness of egalitarianism. The bad guy, Syndrome, is threatening the world with an egalitarian master plot to make everyone into superheroes so that there will be no more superheroes. And the everyone is special doctrine is skewered by Dash when he responds quite profoundly that that is just another way of saying that no one is special.
Ring out your bells, what should you do? We'll strike up your drums for joy. The noblest queen that ever was seen, and it never rained this day. The noblest queen that ever was seen, and it never rained this day. The Scots can tell, the Spanish know well, the Frenchmen cannot deny. But her good grace to more be placed on carrying a gracious eye. But her good grace to more be placed on carrying a gracious eye. Thank you.
Ring out your bells, Pantagruel.
For listening to St. Anne's on Tap. If you like what you hear and want to be eligible to win books, beer steins, and other cool stuff, visit our website at stannespub.com and subscribe to our newsletter.